Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or the Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Welcome back, Smart Daters. I am literally jumping out of my skin with excitement to share this amazing guest with you, someone whose work I have fangirled over for months. In fact, quite frankly, I have to tell you guys, even before we hit record on this podcast, I had to talk to her for 20 minutes just because I wanted to get to know this phenom. So today I have with me, who's going to answer all of your questions, the love doctor, Dr. Terry Orbuch. She is a world-renowned relationship expert, author, speaker, therapist, date and relation coach, and distinguished professor at Oakland University, research professor at University of Michigan. She is a prolific author, a beautiful human being inside and out. She is a wife. She is a mother. She is a gentle soul. Terry, welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast.
Oh, thank you, Bella. That was such an amazing introduction. I am honored to be here today and talk with you and your listeners.
Oh my gosh. I am so excited. You guys, Terry has written, how many books have you written?
Well, I have written three popular books, a lot of academic books that nobody reads, Bella, except my academic colleagues, and my husband hasn't even read them. So I like to say three popular books.
Well, that's amazing. Well, tell us, and I know your books are great, and I have one of them sitting on my desk right now called The Secrets to Surviving Your Children's Love Relationships, and we're going to get into that one at the end, and I might tell you why it's of personal interest to me, because you know I might have an 18-year-old daughter, and I might have a 14-year-old son, and they might be developing into prolific daters. So, Terry, tell us, one of the things I love about you, and there's so many things, is that everything you do is rooted in data. It's rooted in research. It's rooted in science as much as what you and I can do. So tell us about you and this amazing research project that has been following the same couples for over 30 years. Amazing.
It is a wonderful project, Bella. I'm really a scientist at my core. And so I have this NIH, National Institutes of Health project, which is funded by the national government. And as you said, we've been following the same 373 couples now for over 30 years, and we continue to follow them. So I am continuing to submit these applications to the federal government to follow them into the future. It's the largest project of its kind, and we interview them face to face, both as individuals and as couples. 46% of the couples have divorced, which is actually the national average, the divorce rate in the United States. And I always like to say 71% of those people who got divorced have found love again.
Oh,
so I think
great.
That's a wonderful, optimistic statistic from this study. So it's a great project. It's large. It's really has these great data so that I can write the popular books and that they are science-based for everyone as well. So science should be fun. That's what I'm all about, trying to make science fun for all of us.
Yeah, and fun and comprehensible, right? Yeah. So we can actually take from all this amazing research and apply it to our own lives. So if you had to tell us, as you followed this, is it 373 couples you said?
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
And 46% of them divorced. So let's say of the 46% that divorced, what were, let's say, the top three reasons that they divorced?
Good question. Well, the number one reason is what I like to say, frustration. Ooh. And frustration is the difference between what you expect to happen in your relationship. Those should statements that we all have in our mind, we all have them, and the realities of our relationship. So when there's a big difference between what we expect and what we get, we become frustrated. And frustration eats away at happiness in a relationship. And the great thing about my study, Bella, is that I'm able to see when people have these unrealistic expectations about their relationship or relationships in general. I can see happiness decline when the realities of their relationships don't match those unrealistic expectations. So for example, many people think that good relationships have no conflict, or good relationships have little conflict. And that really isn't the case as we've been following these couples over time. It's really all about how you handle the disagreements, not whether you have conflict. And in fact, there were 12 couples in my study in year one who said, we never fight, we never have conflict. None of those couples were still together in year three. So having these unrealistic expectations can really lead to unhappiness, and that breaks couples apart over time. So that's what I say is the number one thing that leads to divorce. Second thing is what I call affirmation. The degree to which you make your partner feel special, seen, cared for, valued, and feel loved. When you feel like you're really loved and seen by your partner, you report, or couples are significantly 2 times less likely to divorce over time. So when a spouse says, yes, my partner makes me feel valued, special, loved, cared for, that couple is 2 times less likely to get divorced over time. And by the way, that is more significant for men than it is for women.
Not surprising.
What I found is that men crave affirmation from their partners much more, and they need it much more to feel okay and happy in their relationships than women do. And at first, this was actually surprising to me, Bella. I'll admit, honestly, it was surprising because I thought it was going to be the opposite, that it would be more important for women than it was for men. But what I found is that men don't get that affirmation, feel loved, valued, cared for outside of their romantic relationship. Whereas women, we get it a lot. We get it from our friends. You just gave me such affirmation in your introduction. But we get it from our sisters, our best friends, our mothers, our children, our neighbors, even the stranger when I walk into a coffee shop and says, oh, Terry, you know, the barista says, Terry, you know, wow, you just got a new haircut. I like it, right? Aww. But men don't get that. And so they crave it, need it for the happiness in a relationship. So it's extremely important, huge science-based strategy to wake up every single day and give your romantic partner affirmation. And you can do that through words or through behaviors. You can tell them you love them, you're great, you're wonderful, I love you more now than I've ever loved you. Or you can show them through a behavior, an action. You can hug them. You can make them a favorite dessert. Turn on the coffee pot in the morning, fix their computer, put gas in their car. Anything that shows your partner that they're seen, because we all want to feel valued.
I will tell you that my husband every morning brings me a hot cup of coffee in bed and usually gives me a hug right after he puts the coffee on the nightstand. And he doesn't have to say to me, wow, you look just as beautiful in the morning after 8 hours of sleep with the sleep mask on and your hair all mussed up as you did last night at the gala. No, it's behaviors. And that makes me every morning feel loved and seen. And when he's out of town, I miss that. And then I tell him, like, this is so special that you do this for me all of the time. So it's an amazing way to affirm your partner. And I tell him every day, this means the world to me. You start my day off in the perfect way. Like, how can the day go badly? Right. And so those strategies work. You guys, listen to this. And even if you are manifesting your soulmate, even if you are going on a date this evening, if you are corresponding with people online right now, if you can find a way to affirm this person, even though they're not yet your partner, find someone in your life to affirm today. You are doing it's God's work. It's crucial work. It is putting more love in the world. You are seeing someone and you are telling them what's good about them instead of just noting it in file 13 in your brain and walking on. You will change the course of that person's day.
Totally. I love all of what you just said, Bella. So very important to put love and kindness out into the world. And by the way, there is an added bonus. When you give affirmation to others, you are more likely to get it in return. It's called the law of reciprocity in psychology, that when we affirm others, not immediately, but over time, that person will affirm us as well. So there is that added bonus, not only a general wonderful thing to add kindness and love in the world and change other people's lives, but you will get it in return as well.
Wow. It's like you get what you give, essentially. Mm-hmm. The law of reciprocity. I like that. That's amazing. And another thing that you said that's so important about frustration and the expectations of no conflict in relationships, right? And so much of that comes from Harlequin romances and Hollywood and Bollywood and social media, but expecting no conflict is such a surefire way for disenchantment in any relationship, a romantic relationship, a friendship. Whenever you have two human beings together that are trying to have an authentic relationship, there will be friction. Right? With employees. I run a company. You teach mm-hmm. students. And the way we teach conflict, both in my house as well as at our team at Smart Dating Academy and in my extended families, conflict is good as long as you have rules of engagement around it. De-escalate it. Don't scream and yell at each other. Have a drink of water. Come back to it in 30 minutes.
Exactly.
And most importantly, look at conflict as a way to get you to a better spot in your relationship. You can look at that. If you imagine your relationship with anybody as climbing a mountain, and it's this beautiful, never-ending mountain, and every time you have a conflict, you use that metaphorically and mentally to say, this conflict and the resolution of it effectively is going to make us more authentic with each other, understand each other better, and we're going to get to a better place. What's bad about that? Look at conflict as a good thing.
As a good thing. And you grow. That's what I hear you saying, is that you will grow. And another thing that I found in my study that's so relevant to what you're saying, Bella, is that people need to address the small things that happen in their romantic relationships. I think we've learned, again, an unrealistic expectation to pick your battles. But I actually found in my study following these couples the opposite. If you wait to pick your battles because you think something is too small or you don't want to bring it up because you might have conflict, it grows inside. And where it may have been easy to deal and address with, he doesn't put the toilet seat back down, or she doesn't roll the toothpaste well, or whatever, a small thing.
Right.
Couples always talk about in my study. But if you don't address it at that point, it grows and it gets bigger and bigger. And then it's really difficult to unpack. You don't love me. You don't hear me. We're not right for one another. And so I think couples also need to understand to bring up small things, not to just pick your battles so that they can get resolved, as you're saying, that we can grow, we can learn how to address our differences.
Oh, I love that so much. And you're so right about picking your battles. If you are constantly pushing down the little things, you become a pressure cooker. And at some point, it's going to burst open in this sort of icky, everything comes out uncontrolled and your feelings are so much more escalated than they should be. So that's really good advice. And what one thing that works with my husband is, you know, what would make me so happy is if you would roll the toothpaste, or if it would make me so happy if you would pick your towel up off the carpet, even though I've told you this 850,000 times in the last 25 years, it would make me so happy if you did that with a smile. And so much of, you know, when we're women, we're doing multiple things. I always say we're like octopuses or octopi, and we've got 8 plates up in the air and we're juggling so many things. And it's like, oh, can you just do this? I've told you so many times. Instead, try and say it from a place of love, because men, to your point, need affirmation ostensibly more than women do. And if you put it in the terms of, it would make me so happy if, right? Because they know if mama's happy, everybody's happy, right? And you've basically told him, this would make me happy. Go do it. Versus, I hate when you don't do this. It's just a little nuance, but it works wonders in our house. And if that one helps you, go for it.
I love that, Bella, and I totally agree with you. And it's focusing on the positive and what you need and using your I statements, which are all wonderful. And another thing that I found in my study, which is relevant to what you said as well, is that when we point out the negative to men, and this came from the males in my study, when you point out the negative or what you're not doing right, they assume that everything is wrong, they're to blame, and they become less positive and less happy over time. So just switching it to, like you said, your I statement, this makes me happy, and what they can do rather than what they're not doing, because they're fixers. They want to fix it, but it's all them, is change it to what you said. Because that was another really interesting finding in my study. Men don't like negatives. Men don't like the problems that we bring up. Instead, refocus it, reframe it.
Oh, I love that so much. And sometimes a useful tool for what Terry's saying is, imagine the man in your life as a 7-year-old boy on the playground who wants to please his teacher or please his mom or please his classmates, and he wants the attaboys. And when you change your phraseology around focusing on the positive, I really loved it when you picked up the towel. That was amazing. You know what? Because with that positive reinforcement, guess what? He'll probably pick it up again tomorrow. And right, I'm just asking for a friend, not that my husband would leave wet towels on the floor. He does sometimes. So super, super interesting. So tell, you know, in your work, Terry, as a dating coach and as a professor and all the amazing things that you do, what do you think is the number one factor that leads singles to finding love?
Well, I can tell you from my work as a date coach and as a professor, but I can also tell you in my long-term study, because we continued to follow the individuals who experienced divorce and who experienced the loss, death of a spouse. Mm. The number one predictor of those people finding love is that they are able to let go of the strong emotional baggage connected to a previous relationship. So what does that mean? That means when people in my study were single said, I don't feel much of anything toward my ex, or I'm neutral. I don't feel strongly positive. I don't feel strongly negative. I'm not pining away. I'm not really pissed at them. Again, when they said, I'm neutral, again, statistically, they were 2 times more likely to find a happy, healthy relationship going forward. So it's very important. I know we all have emotional baggage. We all do, that we have some emotion connected to the past, but I'd like to compare it to going on an airplane, right? You get to the gate and there are some people, I love these people, who get on an airplane and only have a briefcase or a purse or a little small bag. That's not me, by the way, Bella.
Me neither. But me neither.
Me, right. They go right onto the plane. So they have low emotional baggage. They're not strongly connected to the past. They go right forward and meet somebody new or they're onto the plane. But those people who have a large bag, it's overflowing. And then the person at the gate says, stop, you cannot go forward. That's a great metaphor for people who are still strongly emotionally connected to the past. We need to let go of the anger. We need to let go of the wanting, the frustration, the blaming ourselves in order to be fully present, not compare current people or future people to the past, and fully move forward to a new, happy, healthy relationship. So that's what I found in my study. And I've also seen that in my experience with students and my work as a date coach, a marriage and family therapist as well. And I know that we can talk about how to do that, but it's so
that was going to be my next question. Could you read the bubble over my head? Because so many people have been through trauma, things that, you know, death of their soulmate. They've been through, you know, infidelity of every kind, you know, physical infidelity, emotional infidelity, financial infidelity, right? And how do you, is there, how do you do that? So many people come to the dating world and you can tell they're still angry, even though they might've been through years of therapy. Like, is there something that we can do to reduce, to get to that place that you're talking about where you are at least net neutral to your past?
Right. Well, first of all, it is very challenging. And I have to recognize exactly what you're saying. It is difficult. It is hard. It is normal that you come and you do have that emotional baggage, that anger, that frustration, that disappointment at yourself or others. So I just have to say that people are not alone. It's not just you. Yeah. I think that there are many strategies, but my favorite strategy, Bella, is what I call reassigning blame. So when we experience a relationship breakup or a divorce, we tend to blame other partner. He had an affair. She wasn't emotionally available. She, you know, wasn't this, whatever it may be. Or we blame ourselves. I wasn't ready. I could have done this. I should have done that. When we blame other partner, we hold on to the anger and the frustration. And when we blame ourselves, we hold on to the sadness, the pining, the desire to have that person back in our life. So what we want to do is reassign the blame and make we blame statements. They're called relationship blame statements. And there's so much great research to support this. So if we can say my relationship ended because we weren't compatible, because we were too young when we got married, because we had different relationship goals, we didn't know how to communicate or handle conflict well. When we blame the relationship or us, you can even hear it in my voice when I make a we statement that it lets go of the anger or the disappointment or sadness or pining and desire. And so that's a really interesting strategy that we can use if we want to let go of the past or if we have to let go of the past. And I have clients write down 4 or 5 statements and say them every day. Because what we want to try to do from a psychological point of view is change our brainwaves, change what we automatically think And that takes at least 21 days of doing a different habit, of doing a different routine. So writing, saying, seeing those we blame statements over 21 days. I even tell clients to do it right before you go to bed, because then you have the benefit of 8, 7, 6 hours, whatever hours you get of sleep, of your brain focusing on that new brain habit. So 2 times a day for 21 days, we statements, you will find that you will let go of that emotional baggage. So that's one strategy.
Let me ask you a question right on that, because I love this so much. And I want, so let's say my partner cheated on me. How do I turn that into a we statement?
Mm-hmm. And it is very difficult because we want to blame that person.
Right?
And my partner did the infidelity. I didn't. But think about what you want or need and what your partner wants or needs. We were not compatible in our view of commitment. We had different ideas about what it takes to have a happy, loving relationship. We wanted different things from each other.
I
so
love
when we
that.
Do that, we let go of that anger that I know we have if there's been a betrayal or an infidelity. And there are betrayals. Betrayals are when somebody breaks our trust. And there are many betrayals that occur in relationships, only one of which is infidelity.
Right, right, right. And that's such a great, poignant example, right? Because so often we want to, as you said, when we blame the other person, we feel angry. When we blame ourselves and we turn that mirror inward, we feel sadness. And sadness and anger, they suck, right? Like, let's just call a spade a spade. Those are not emotions any of us really want to be feeling. I don't know if one is better or worse than the other. They're both, you know,
they're part both, of being human. Right. They're both detrimental to us when we feel them, but also think about going out on a first date with somebody who's really angry or really sad. That's not the person who you're going to have or want a second date with. No. So turn that around. If you are angry, if you haven't let go of that, or you are sad, pining away, and you haven't let go of that, you are most likely not going to be the person that somebody wants a second date with either.
Exactly. Because if you put that anger or that sadness out there, people are looking for that, guys. They are looking for that on the first, second, third, fourth, fifth date. Like, are you angry? Are you bitter? Are you still sad about the loss of your loved one, right? So we're very, our antennae are tuned in for those things from a self-protection standpoint. I want to make sure if I go out on a date with a man that has lost his wife in the last few years, my first question is he through the tunnel yet? He'll never get over it, but is he in a good place? So what are my antennae looking for? I'm holding up my red flag. Any signs of sadness or not having walked through the tunnel, right? The only way to get through something is to get through it and to walk through it, right? There's no skirting
Exactly. And it doesn't mean you have to forget it. Like you're saying, when a widow experienced the loss of a romantic partner, you don't have to forget that person. Yeah. You don't have to forget or not grieve or even come birthday or anniversary, forget that person. But like you said, get through the tunnel.
Get through the tunnel. Yeah, absolutely. And now, speaking of relationships, and now let's flip the switch here. Let's say we found someone and we think, oh my gosh, I call them, you know, the lid to your pot. And that's kind of our, you know, let's say that you think you found the lid to your pot and maybe you've been on 15 dates or 20 dates, or you've been exclusive with this person for 6 to 12 months. Terry, in your vast experience, is there a way to ascertain, is this person the one?
Mm-hmm. I think the answer is yes.
Oh,
there is a way.
Okay.
There are 3 questions that I think you want to ask yourself. First is about trust. Do you trust this person? And do you have a trusting relationship? Because when we look at relationships, Bella, over time, trust is the number one essential, vital, most important ingredient to a happy, healthy relationship. If you don't have trust, you can't have commitment, you can't have love, and you can't last for a long time. So trust is really important. And we're talking about, and when we're talking about trust, we're saying that this person is open and honest and has my best interests at heart, and they're predictable. That's, I think, the definition of trust in the academic world. And I think so there are questions that you can ask yourself. Is this person reliable? Do they have my best interests at heart? And it's not that they only think of me, but let's say we're going out for dinner and they know that I'm a vegetarian. Do they pick a steakhouse? Right? Or if they know I'm, you know, having money issues this week or month, do they pick the most expensive thing to do when we're both paying? So they're thinking of me and my best interests. And it's so very important. And if you can't decipher that, I encourage people to have what I call a trust chat, which means you sit down with that person and you talk about what's your definition of commitment. What is trust to you? What do you think about infidelity, right? So you want to have a trust chat. So that's question one. Question two is, do we have the same key life values? And so I'm not talking about similarity in hobbies or interests, because as I have followed people over time in my study, that does not predict staying together. But what does predict, the number one thing that predicts people staying together, that was going to be my number three. When you asked number three, I forgot to get to it, is similarity in key life values, underlying values, like the importance of children and family, the role of faith or spirituality in my life, or the importance of my career and work and balance between career and personal. And you need similarity in those key life values in order to predict whether or not this is the right person for you. And then finally, number three, question number three is, how do you do in terms of handling conflict and stress together? As I said before, those couples who handle stress and conflict well together are more likely to stay together and happy over time.
Wow, I love it. So the 3 points, you guys, if you're taking notes like I am, trust, values, and how do we handle conflict, right? Mm-hmm. That's your measure to see if someone is the one. Notice how she didn't say we have sex 6 times a day. You might, you might, and good on you, but long-term love is fueled by these things, a relationship that's based on trust, that's based on similarity and values and what you want out of life and how you navigate conflict. Because remember earlier in this chat, Dr. Terry said the 12 couples out of her 373 in the beginning that said they never fought, they never had conflict. 12 for 12 are divorced.
Exactly.
Bananas.
And, you know, people, Bella, always ask me, clients and others, well, you know, we've been dating for 3-4 months. We don't have any conflict. We have never, never disagreed, right? So I encourage you to think about instead stressful situations, like when you're going to the airport and you and your partner have a flat tire. How do you and your partner handle that? When you miss your plane? When something else stressful happens, a parent gets sick, you get COVID, for example, and both of you have to quarantine. How do you handle those stressful situations? Because what we know studies show is that couples who don't handle stress or conflict well now don't handle it well later. So look for those kinds of situations if that's your response or comment to, we don't have conflict or differences. Look for stressful situations and how do you handle those together?
I love that. I tell my clients, your issues when you're dating usually are your issues when you're married as well. Yes. So if you're not handling conflict well, ladies and gents, in the first 6 months and somebody's throwing the microwave across the room or screeching out of the driveway, might be a bit of a red flag. How do we handle conflict? Can we navigate it? Because you will miss that plane. Somebody will get COVID. You'll both get COVID. You'll both have important meetings and the child is sick. Like, how do you navigate? Do you turn towards each other and help and support and figure out together? And are you solution oriented or do we turn into making the other person the victim? Right. Exactly. And that's super destructive and hard to do. Now, I had this little question that popped into my head as I said, okay, if we're not having sex six times a day, haha. But truly, Terry, how does one decide or ascertain, am I in lust or am I in love? How do we do that? How do we know if it's lust or love?
Such a good question, right? And lust is fueled by sexual hormones and sex and arousal. And love is fueled by support and friendship and intimacy, as we said. So I have a TED talk on this exact topic. And what I talk about is first, by the way, you can have both in long-lasting relationship. You can have lust and love. But let's say we're in a relationship and we're dating and we want to know, is it lust or is it love? And I think that there are four signals that you want to look for. First, when we're in love, we want the people that are important to us to connect with our partner. And we want our partner to connect and like the people that are important to us. So if we were in love, we want our romantic partner to meet our friends and our best friends, and we want them to spend time with those people, and we want those people to like those people in our life. When we're in lust, we are not so interested in that, Bella. We may not care, or we may not even think about it.
So I love that.
That's one cue or signal. Second, when we're in love, we talk in we terms. So let's say somebody asks us, what did you do last weekend, Bella? And you say, well, we went to the movies. We went for a walk. We went shopping. We went on a hike outside. That signals love. But if you told me, Bella, well, I went to the movies and then I went out to dinner. And on Saturday, I went for a hike. That signals non-love or lust. So listen to your language because that's the second signal. The third signal is that when we're in love, we want to share and tell this person personal information about ourselves. Sometimes it's information that we haven't ever even told anyone else. So if you feel that urge, like you want to tell this person deep, dark secrets about your childhood or about what's going on, what stresses you, your best friends, you want to share and reveal, that's love. And if you, again, don't really want to do that, don't really want to talk about you and the core of you, instead, you might be talking about politics, religion, sports, that's more likely to be lust. And then final cue or signal, number four, is that when people are in love, they're interdependent, meaning a change in one person creates a change in another person. And when you're going to make a change, you want to go to your partner and ask them how they feel about it. So let's say you get a new job in a different state. Do you call that partner and say, hey, you know, I have to move to Minnesota, right? What do you think about that? Will that work? But if you just accept the job and don't even call, don't even recognize that that person may also change because of your move, lust. not love. So we're talking about connectiveness, we language, revealing parts of self, and interconnectedness equals love, not lust.
Ladies and gentlemen, I mean, I'm like, you know, gems are dropping. My pen is flying here so I can take all these notes to put in the show notes for you guys. I mean, this is amazing. These are some, like I said, the gems, the diamonds, like, I hope you listen to this again and again, because Dr. Orbuch knows what she's talking about, you guys. As my husband will say, when we're in such agreement with each other, like, I know, it's like, he calls it violent agreement. I'm in violent agreement with everything you say. I don't know why he calls it violent, but it's like so passionately, we're so simpatico into it. He's like, we're in violent agreement, which is hilarious because he's like the least violent person you've met. So I promised at the beginning of this, we would come back to your new book called Secrets to Surviving Your Children's Love Relationships. Tell us a little bit. I mean, I know what it is because it's on my desk dog-eared, but tell our dear listeners, what is this book about and what motivated you to write it?
Thank you, Bella. And this is one of my favorite books because, you know, as a parent, we want what's best for our children.
Amen.
I mean, it's that biological situation that happens when we have children. We want what's best for them. And study after study, science after science shows that happy, healthy relationships are vital, as I said, essential to our children's health and well-being. But as I talk to parents all across the world, they didn't know how to start conversations with their children about healthy relationships, skills that are important, all the things that we've been talking about today, Bella. Thank you. They didn't know how to start those conversations or what to tell their children. So that's why I wrote the book. It really is for parents who want their children to have happy, healthy relationships. It's all about having these meaningful, important conversations and discussions with our children, how to start them, how to do them, what to say during those conversations, and how to model happy, healthy relationships in front of your children. Because we set the tone, us, even if we're not in a romantic relationship, we set the tone in all of our relationships, how we interact and behave, for how our children will do and experience their relationships. So that's what the book is about. And I mean, I love it. It's my favorite book.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
It's amazing. And I know what really kind of hit me between the eyes. It's exactly what you said in when we're talking about how do you know if you're really in love with somebody? And your first answer was, do I trust this person? Do we have a trusting relationship? And you said it's the same thing with your child, right? Do you have a trusting relationship? After I read that part of your book, I asked my son, Max, who's quirky and he's such a bro and like a cool dude, 14-year-old, like graduating eighth grade. I'm like, do you trust me? And he's like, I guess. I'm like, you guess? Okay, right. Well, there was that one time where you did this, right? Because he's that little grudge holder. And he, remember when you told so-and-so's mom what I told you? I said, I've apologized for that 7 times, Max, and I'll apologize again. You're right. I shouldn't have said that to that mom. That was one thing. But how about the 99,999 others? And he's like, yeah, I mean, besides that, I think we're good, right? So it's, and I said, you know what? I trust you too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that, Bella, because those are the kinds of conversations that we want and need to have with our kids. I mean, just sitting down and saying what you said to your son is amazing, wonderful, and I love it because it's going to build trust. It's going to show your son that trust is important in a relationship, that you think it's important. And by the way, as we said, it is the number one important thing in a relationship. So having that conversation and just going back and forth and validating, as you did with your son, yes, I realize that was a mistake, but now I've apologized. How can we go forward? Are the conversations that we have to have with our kids. I have the same. I mean, many people think that the relationships with my kids or husband is perfect. And that's not true.
No.
I have to work.
We're talking about conflict. You and I have been married between the two of us for 55 years.
Exactly. Long time. Many years. And so there are always ups and downs. And we make mistakes, even us as relationship experts. And so I need to apologize. And that's another thing that I talk about in the book is how do we as parents apologize? Recognize our mistakes, because if we want our kids to do that, not only with us, but in their relationships, it's important to understand what is a good apology and how do you do good apologies?
Yeah. How do you do good apologies? Right. And you're right. And you say in this book also, good relationships for your children start with you, their parent, right? What does that mean? I mean, I think I know what it means, but I want to hear your intent for what it means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, our children are watching so much that's happening around them, whether it be social media, whether it be television, TikToks, you know, reading romance novels, whatever it may be, their friends, parents, they're being inundated with examples and illustrations of relationships, some of them good and some of them not so good. But as parents, we can start now, regardless of the age of your child, whether they're young or old or young adults, we can start now by setting the tone, as I said, about having these great conversations, which are the conversations we really want them to have with their romantic partners as well, but also having conflict in front of them and resolving it. I share the story of my son coming into the family room, and my husband and I were disagreeing about who should have the
remote control.
Thank you. I even forgot the word, the remote clicker. Control. Thank you. And we were going back and forth. No, I would like the remote control. No, I would. And my son looked at us, I think he was 16, and said, are you getting a divorce? And I thought at that moment, we have not had conflict, disagreements, or differences enough in front of him and resolved them. Because when kids grow up not seeing conflict, the first time they have conflict in a relationship, they think their relationship is in trouble. So if we can set the tone to have those differences and agreements, not in the bedroom, not at night when they can't hear, but in front of them and resolve them well, constructively, as you gave examples of, which were great, then we can be good examples, role models, and good relationships can start with us. And that's just one example, but all kinds of things. We can talk to each other with respect. We can give affirmation. If I give affirmation to my husband every morning and my kids hear, then they can see, wow, look at his face. He smiled after he got that affirmation. Look, Bella was so happy when she got the coffee in bed in the morning. I'm recognizing and seeing that that's important in terms of relationships and happiness. So good relationships for your children start with you as a parent.
Preach. Wow. I have like goosebumps from head to toe. Terry, you have been incredibly generous with your knowledge. You're doing work that will impact many generations to come with your amazing work. And I'm so grateful that you were here to share your gems with us. And I know that this will be the first of many times you'll hopefully be on the Smart Dating Academy podcast and lots more fun things to come. Because we discovered we're neighbors between Chicago and Michigan.
We are neighbors. We are both Midwestern gals at the moment.
Exactly.
And I would love to come again. Thank you so much for inviting me, Bella. This has been so much fun for me as well.
Yay! Thank you. Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.